Staff Sergeant Aquilino Gonell was one of many Capitol Police officers who were brutally beaten by rioters during the insurrection on January the 6th. Months afterward, Sergeant Gonell testified to the January 6th committee, quote, "My fellow officers and I were punched, pushed, kicked, shoved, sprayed with chemical irritants, and even blinded with eye-damaging lasers by a violent mob who apparently saw us law enforcement officers dedicated to, ironically, protecting them as U.S. citizens as an impediment in their attempted insurrection. I vividly heard officers screaming in agony and pain just as an arm's length from me. I, too, was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, trampled, defending this entrance," end quote. Because of the injuries he sustained on January 6th, Staff Sergeant Gonell had to retire from the force. But in some ways, he's still reliving that day. Just yesterday, former Sergeant Gonell had to testify during a sentencing hearing for one of the Capitol rioters who brutally attacked him on January the 6th. Michael Mackerel from Wellington, Ohio, pleaded guilty last year to a felony for assaulting police officers. According to court documents, Mackerel tackled multiple police officers and at one point wrapped his arm around the neck of a U.S. Capitol police officer and threw the officer to the ground. Yesterday, Michael Mackerel was sentenced to 27 months in prison. He joins over 1,300 others who've been charged for their role in the violence. And with each passing day, more perpetrators are being arrested, including a conservative influencer arrested this week. She allegedly helped steal a table from inside the Capitol that was then used to assault police on January 6th. Last week, another man was arrested for allegedly firing a pistol into the air multiple times as the crowd around him surged. John Banuelos was one of many insurrectionists who took weapons, including guns and machetes, to the Capitol that day. It's important to remember all of this, just to remember how terrible and traumatic January 6th was, because more than 3 years later, as we continue to watch this near continuous stream of arrests connected to the violence on January 6th, this is how the Republican Party's presumptive nominee, the man who, let's not forget, incited that riot, this is how he decided to kick off a campaign speech this weekend in Ohio.
Ladies and gentlemen, please rise for the horribly and unfairly treated January 6th hostages.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed as the twilight's last gleaming.
Well, thank you very much. And you see the spirit from the hostages, and that's what they are, as hostages. They've been treated terribly and very unfairly.
Now, if you're thinking to yourself that nails on chalkboard rendition of the national anthem sounds a tad familiar, you'd be right. Trump has played that rendition at multiple rallies. And it's not because Trump thinks those jailed Capitol rioters are vocal prodigies. His reference to January 6th hostages are now a campaign mainstay. And it serves a very specific purpose, ripped right from the pages of the authoritarian playbook. Yale historian Timothy Snyder has for years now been warning of the eerie similarities between our current political trajectory and the rise of authoritarianism in early 20th century Europe. He points out that Trump's recasting of January 6th rioters as martyrs in his campaign speech last weekend has some chilling echoes in the past. Before Hitler came to power, chief Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels worked hard to find a violent Nazi who could be portrayed as a victim of the far left. He eventually found a dubious character called Horst Wessel, who became the subject of the Nazis' main song. Trump has made an eerily similar move, turning his coup criminals into musicians of martyrdom, end quote. Musicians of martyrdom. And this is not the only fascist tactic that Snyder sees in Trump's rhetoric. Trump's Ohio speech was riddled with dehumanizing language, specifically when it comes to immigrants. Language that Professor Snyder says summons up the fascist historical context. Here's some of what Trump said about migrants at the southern border.
They're in jail for years, if you call them people, I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion. But I'm not allowed to say that because the radical left says that's a terrible thing to say. They say you have to vote against him because did you hear what he said about humanity? I've seen the humanity, and these humanity, these are bad. These are animals, okay? And we have to stop it.
Trump's dehumanization of immigrants, the martyrdom of the so-called January 6th hostages, these are the context, Snyder argues, for the moment in that speech that set off alarm bells for many people. A moment in which Trump threatened that if he loses in November, there's going to be a bloodbath. Here is exactly what he said.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. That'll be the least of it is important here. That part of the speech set off alarm bells for a reason, but the hand-wringing began immediately. What did Trump really mean? Was he just talking about cars, or was he actually threatening violence? Trump himself tried to clear it up today in an interview with the British far-right politician-turned-broadcaster Nigel Farage.
So bloodbath, talking about it's going to be a bloodbath in the auto industry because we're going to lose our whole industry because this guy's going to all electric cars. And they're made in China.
Ah, bloodbath in the auto industry. Trump is saying nothing to see here. Liberals are getting stirred up about nothing. I was talking about cars. But as Professor Snyder points out, quote, Trump is calling for a bloodbath in front of people who stood to dishonor bloodshed, to honor bloodshed. People who have just sung with coup criminals. People whom he implicitly promises he will pardon if they carry out another insurrection. And he's doing this in the fascist style of telling a big lie that confers martyrdom upon criminals who try to overthrow a democracy they associated with subhumans. We should see Trump for what he is, an aspiring fascist who likes, wants, and needs violence. End quote. Joining us now is the Yale historian, Professor Tim Snyder. Professor, good to see you. Thank you for being here in person. This is a remarkable conversation because people have spent the last couple of days saying he was just talking about the cars. Now, I'm an economics reporter. We've not used that term, bloodbath, about cars. But what you write about is that it's the context. It's not just whether he said that sentence about cars. It's everything else he said in the speech, starting with the salute of the hostages.
Yeah. I mean, when he refers to the cars, he's then clearly switching gears. He's saying the cars will be the least of it.
Right.
It'll be a bloodbath for the whole country. And the folks who are saying the context is the cars, what they're actually doing is ripping it out of context. Because the context is the whole fascist history of violence, the whole fascist history of martyrdom cults, Trump's prior insurrection attempt in January of 2021, and the physical context. That he's just got people to sing along with the criminals of January 6th. That's the real context.
You write, those who speciously insist that Trump had in mind an automotive bloodbath never mentioned that he had just celebrated criminals, repeated the big lie, dehumanized people, and followed fascist patterns. You lay out in your article the pattern of that speech. All of that was done before he brought up cars for one sentence and then went back to violence.
Before I came down here, I was talking to my 11-year-old daughter, and she said, you know, with dictators, Dad, you just have to listen to what they said.
And so much of She's learned well from
yeah, me. Well, so much of this discussion, you just have to listen to what the man says. You can look for excuses in good faith or bad faith. You cannot want to look at what he's actually saying. You can decide that you like the bloodshed, so you're going to lie about it now. You can decide you're going to look away. But the actual context are those human beings around him who have been asked to identify by singing and standing with violent criminals who tried to overthrow our system. That's the context.
There's something important here. You've told us we got the term the big lie, or we applied it to this from work that you had done. Donald Trump is not acting like a normal politician who expects to win or is even trying to win. He doesn't need to win more votes. He just needs to be in the ballpark because he's laid the groundwork for you not believing that he would have lost the election.
Yeah. It's also important in this speech, if we're talking about context, that at least 9 times he himself invokes the big lie.
Correct.
And in doing that, he embraces the people around him in this alternative reality. And then in alternative reality, it's not the number of votes that's going to count. It's the feeling of having won that's going to count. And that's why we have to understand his words as preparation for a November 24 insurrection. That's what he's after.
Let's think about the term we use these days is dog whistle. The idea that you say something that people who attuned to it can hear. What's the historical precedent for this? Donald Trump says things. The rest of us can be hand-wringing about whether or not he meant automotive bloodbath or whether he didn't. But the point is it's landing with the people to whom he needs it to land.
Yeah, I mean, that's one point. It's definitely landing with the people around him. But I think we also have the problem that our immediate impulse is to say, well, let's try to find an excuse for him. Let's try to both sides this. Let's try to suppress this. No, you can only beat this sort of thing if you recognize what it is.
How do you think we should handle these sorts of things? Because we typically don't carry a Trump rally, but he has them all the time. And as you note in your article, this is not new. This is not weird. He just every time introduces something that he hasn't said before. But this concept of immigrants as animals or subhuman, vermin, poisoning the blood of the nation, this is not brand new. What do you do? What do you do in the face of this?
Yeah. First of all, cover the rallies. I mean, in 2016, his rallies predicted pretty well what kind of a president who's going to be. And we have the same thing again, and we're not covering the rallies well enough. There are some reporters doing it. Susan Glazer just wrote a nice piece. But in general,
she thinks people should. She thinks people should actually go listen to them or watch the whole thing, painful though it may be, to understand what's going on.
Take it all in. Take it literally. Think about it, report on it, rather than just doing the kind of distant analysis, finding the excuses. Listen to the man, because as you say, his strategy is just get close enough to make some kind of a play. And we've got 6 or 7 months to explain to Americans that this is the bloodbath candidate, that what he's trying to do is get close enough and threaten violence. There are a lot of undecided voters out there, maybe folks not here in New York, but a lot of folks out there who haven't thought about this stuff yet. But when they hear what he's going to try to do, it will matter to them. That's the political work to be done.
The problem, of course, is that everybody has this impulse to say he's just saying that. In fact, he said it was on Fox News this weekend, in which he talked about why he uses this inflammatory language. Let's just see if we can play this.
Here's my theory, that you use over-the-top, sometimes inflammatory language, because that drives the media debate. Did Trump go too far? And then you get the next several news cycles talking about your issue and, you know, whether your language was too much or wasn't enough. Any thought that I might be right on that?
It also gets people thinking about very important issues, that if you don't use certain rhetoric, if you don't use certain words that maybe are not very nice words, nothing will happen.
He's laying out the excuse for people who don't want to believe him. He's saying, it's just rhetoric. It's to make people think about important things, calling people immigrants vermin and subhuman and talking about bloodbaths.
Well, if you listen to what he said, if you don't use the not very nice words, things won't happen. In other words, if you use the nasty words, things will happen. And he's right. I mean, the fascists, authoritarians, they didn't personally have to kill people.
Right.
They used language. And that specific dehumanizing language of calling people beasts and saying my opponents can't be in power because they're the ones who are on the side of the beasts, that has a very specific history. So the words are the actions. The words matter in themselves.
Because the goal is to get people to take on these ideas and deal with them.
The goal
themselves.
Is to say these other people on that side, the ones who help the animals, they're not real Americans.
Right.
They can't possibly be in power. This can't possibly be legitimate. And so combining it with the notion of elections that are faked, the idea that they're on the side of the subhumans is meant to rally people so that they think that violence is acceptable. And we know this can work, because his words caused violence on January 6, 2021. And he knows it can work, and that's what he's going for.
Professor, good to see you in person. Thank you for being with us. Professor Tim Snyder is a professor of history at Yale University. All right, coming up, it's primary night. We're going to get the latest from Ohio, where a Trump-backed candidate has just won the Republican Senate primary and will take on the Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown in the fall. But first, while Trump struggles to come up with $500 million in fines, his son-in-law is working on major business deals in Serbia and Albania. I'll talk to the New York Times reporter who broke that news next.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
It's Monday night.
It's Monday, everyone. Happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC.
Monday night.
Let me tell you a story that might seem complicated, but it's really quite straightforward. As always, all you have to do is follow the money. A little over a decade ago, Donald Trump, then just a private businessman, meets with the Prime Minister of Serbia and tells him how much he would like to build a luxury hotel in the Serbian capital of Belgrade. It doesn't happen. But a few years later, Donald Trump is the president of the United States. And President Trump sends a special envoy to help mediate Serbia's peace process with neighboring Kosovo. The guy Trump sends, this guy, named Rick Grenell, doesn't really have any experience in this arena, but he quickly endears himself to the Serbian government by basically siding with them on everything they want. While he's there, Mr. Grenell makes a lot of new friends. He likes to go clubbing with the Serbian Minister of Finance, for instance. Looks fun. And Rick Grenell also tells his new Serbian government friends that they really should consider the idea of an American real estate development in Belgrade. Meanwhile, Trump's son-in-law and the White House advisor, Jared Kushner, is spending time making fast friends with the autocratic de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia. When Kushner leaves the White House, Saudi Arabia dumps $2 billion into Kushner's brand new investment fund. And now the New York Times reports that Rick Grenell and his Serbian friends and Jared Kushner and his Saudi billions are teaming up to finally realize Donald Trump's dream of that luxury hotel development in Belgrade, along with other big real estate projects in the Balkans. According to a draft outline of the Belgrade agreement obtained by the New York Times, the Serbian government could turn over the land and the entire development to Kushner free of charge. Which I happen to think is a very nice thing for a foreign government to do for the Trump family. As Donald Trump locks up the presidential nomination while facing hundreds of millions of dollars in legal judgments against him. Joining us now is the New York Times investigative reporter Eric Lipton, who has been covering these deals. Eric, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. I tried not to have that drip with too much sarcasm, but it's kind of an amazing situation when you pull it all together and see who the characters are involved in this development.
Yeah, we were startled when we learned that this was a project that had first been proposed and considered by, you know, then Trump businessman in 2013. And that, in fact, some representatives of the Trump organization had traveled to Serbia and looked at the site and met with the prime minister and you know, reported back to Trump. But then the project went nowhere because shortly after that, Trump was running for president and the international deal stopped. But it was really, that was the thing that surprised us, was that this project, its provenance had started all the way back in 2013 at Trump Tower during a meeting with the prime minister of Serbia. And the same prime minister then, you know, was commenting on it today. He's now a member of parliament. He's now the foreign minister. But he was commenting on the same project today and before the parliament and defending the proposal.
Now, I want to be clear in the reporting. Both Kushner and Grenell say that Donald Trump has nothing to do with this.
That's right. I mean, Trump, in fact, financially is not involved with this project at all. And Trump and Grenell and Kushner both assert it was, you know, sort of hard for me to accept, but they both assert that they were unaware that Donald Trump had considered this site. And I said to each of them in conversations, I said, it's a bit hard to imagine that we're talking about not only the same country, the same city, but the exact same property that you now are proposing to build a hotel. Which is, you know, and that's what, you know, Trump had proposed back in 2013. But they do assert that they were unaware that Trump had considered this site for a hotel back in 2013 and 2014.
This, of course, these business interests tied to the Donald Trump family are interesting in this moment in time, because we're just getting news this week that Donald Trump has got until next week, but he's having trouble raising a bond for the fine he has to pay up. So we have a bit of more of a picture about Donald Trump's financial situation, in that he cannot, without liquidating something, probably come up with $500 million. Makes the idea of big developments around the world more compelling.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is not a Trump project. This is a Kushner project. And, you know, Kushner has for the last 3 years been gradually building his investment fund investments. And this would be the largest group of investments that he's done so far. There's two in Albania and one in Serbia. The one in Serbia alone is estimated to be, you know, about $500 million investment. So we're talking more than $1 billion in these three investments. I mean, the thing that struck us when we looked at them is that the projects in both in Serbia and Albania require actions by the governments there to grant them, you know, the right to use a federal property. And in Albania, it's a former military site that would be turned into a luxury resort. And in Serbia, it's the former headquarters of the Yugoslavian military, which was bombed by NATO in 1999, has been sitting largely vacant. In both cases, those sites are controlled by the government. So Kushner would require an act of the government to get access to these sites. And, you know, then they know that his father-in-law is running for president. And that just creates some questions about why these actions might be happening.
Now, it's not that Serbia hasn't had anything to say about Donald Trump running for president. In fact, it's been a pretty pro-Trump government.
Yeah, they are supportive. You know, Rick Grenell had a pretty positive relationship with the president and prime minister and other ministers there. And you know, they did work to try to bring some reconciliation between Kosovo and Serbia in 2020. And they had, you know, some success in bringing some reconciliation. But, you know, Trump is pretty popular in Serbia, much more popular in Serbia than in Kosovo. And so they like him, and they have, you know, good working relations. And I think that they've expressed the fact that they would be fine with Trump being the president again. So the challenge here is that, you know, Jared asserts that, you know, he knows that the spotlight is on him and that he must do everything completely above board, and he's committed to doing that. But the challenge, even like it was when Trump first ran for president, when you have someone who is, you know, potentially in the White House and they're getting concessions from foreign governments, it can create an appearance of conflict of an interest, even if it isn't a real conflict, it can create an appearance of one.
Eric, thank you for your reporting on this. We appreciate it. The New York Times investigative reporter Eric Lipton. All right, more ahead this evening, including the latest in key primary races tonight, like Ohio's GOP Senate race, where all eyes are on the new Trump-endorsed Republican nominee, Bernie Moreno. But first, a Supreme Court ruling in a case out of Texas hints at a potential about-face by the court on the well-established precedent that the federal government, and not the states, not any state, has the sole authority to regulate immigration. We'll have more on that right after the break.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Alpha 1-9er, commence Wi-Fi device checklist.
Laptops, on. TVs, streaming. Game console, consoling. Smart thermostat, set for cuddle time. Doorbell camera, oh, my package is here.
Fast, reliable, able to power tons of devices inside your home at once.
All systems go, you are clear for takeoff.
This is Xfinity Internet, Wi-Fi built to wow. And watch the short film, The Aviators, now playing at Xfinity.com. Restrictions apply, actual speeds vary and are not guaranteed.
The court struck down some key portions of that controversial law in Arizona meant to crack down on illegal immigration. The court said today, in effect, the federal government gets to deal with immigration, not the states.
In 2012, the Supreme Court struck down parts of Arizona's immigration bill, known then as the Show Me Your Papers law. That legislation targeted undocumented migrants by making it a crime to not carry federal registration papers in the state. But the justices made it clear in their ruling that it wasn't up to Arizona to decide, saying, quote, the government of the United States has broad, undoubted power over the subject of immigration and the status of aliens. The federal power to determine immigration policy is well settled, end quote. It appears now that the Supreme Court may have changed its mind. Today, the court decided to allow Texas, for now, to enforce a new law that gives police the power to arrest migrants suspected of illegally crossing the state's border with Mexico. The justices rejected an emergency request from the Biden administration to block the law, and the administration's argument that Texas's law violates the federal government's sole authority to legislate on immigration. This legal battle over Texas's law is not over. A federal appeals court will hear oral arguments in this case tomorrow. That's a new development this evening. So this law could still be blocked at a later date. But for now, the Supreme Court is contradicting its own precedent and giving Texas the authority to set its own immigration policy. Joining me now is Joyce Vance, MSNBC legal analyst and professor at the University of Alabama School of Law. In real life, Joyce, it's so great to see you. It's so rare that we do this. This is a remarkably important story. It's actually not so much to do with immigration policy, and you can dislike the federal government's take on immigration policy, but the concept that immigration is a thing for governments to do with other governments, not for the states to be involved in, is an important precedent.
It is, and the Supreme Court in the 2012 Arizona case that you referenced made that very clear. They said there's a supremacy clause. The federal government has the sole authority to legislate, to impose policy on immigration. And it's easy to understand why, right? What if Mexico had to deal with 50 different state policies instead of one national policy? It also, this Texas law, will impose a big burden on state law enforcement officers and on federal law enforcement officers by disrupting the normal path for immigration enforcement.
So one has to separate in their mind the idea that one, like they did in Arizona, like they do in Texas, may disagree with federal immigration policies. But why would the Supreme Court entertain this idea? Because this could become a slippery slope. If you start letting states decide immigration policy, they'll all start deciding immigration policy.
Yeah, this one is a tough to understand, a tough one. The best explanation I can give you is that this was not the Supreme Court's decision on the merits of the case. This is at an early stage. The issues are still being litigated in the lower courts. The only issue right now is whether this law can stay in effect while the courts are litigating the merits of the law itself. And it's a little bit unusual. The Fifth Circuit put an administrative stay in. That's supposed to just be a temporary device that lets the courts decide how things will proceed while the case is taking place. But the Fifth Circuit took a long time here. And we saw that in today's opinion, where Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who was joined by Brett Kavanaugh, suggested that if the Fifth Circuit didn't act quickly, the United States could come back to the court again. The response, is, as you pointed out, is that the Fifth Circuit will hold an argument tomorrow morning. But again, only on this issue of whether the law can remain in effect while the underlying litigation proceeds.
And the Supreme Court seemed to imply that they would like the reasoning from the Fifth Circuit. So in other words, there's an opening for the idea that tell me why you think that this law should be, that Texas should be able to decide immigration issues. That said, there's a fairly good amount of established law that doesn't support Texas's position.
This is not a close call. There is no law that supports Texas's position. The Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, said, well, we're being invaded in Texas by immigrants. And so under the provision of the Constitution that permits a state to respond to an invasion, we are able to do this. In oral argument before the court, in the papers that the Solicitor General's office filed, the Solicitor General said, Texas is not under attack. This is not an invasion by an army. This isn't an imminent danger for the state of Texas, and they're not permitted to use that provision of the Constitution to justify this law. She is correct. There is just simply no authority for Texas's position.
So the way this goes is that the Fifth Circuit holds oral arguments, has oral arguments tomorrow. They will come to some decision, and then probably ends up at the Supreme Court again?
Probably either way. But remember, this is still just on the issue of whether the law can remain in effect while there's
not
other
on the
litigation
actual,
on the merits. Yes.
Let's talk about Donald Trump's immunity issue that we're all waiting for. His legal team has filed a brief detailing their legal arguments that they're going to make before the Supreme Court next month. Let me just read from you from this. It says a denial of criminal immunity would incapacitate every future president with de facto blackmail and extortion while in office and condemn him to years of post office trauma at the hands of political opponents. The threat of future prosecution and imprisonment would become a political cudgel to influence the most sensitive and controversial presidential decisions, taking away the strength, authority and decisiveness of the presidency. The lower court already heard that argument. This is just a rephrasing of what they heard. Tell me what you think of this.
Yeah, I mean, same argument. You know, it's funny how in our nation's history, this has never been a problem for any president except Donald Trump. And so his argument applies, but it only applies to a president who wants to commit criminal acts.
Right. Right. And he's made that point. The other thing that his team says in here is trauma at the hands of political opponents. Donald Trump likes to play this distraction game that this isn't about an alleged crime that I committed. This is something driven by my political opponents. That also didn't hold water with the court.
It didn't. You know, Donald Trump argues that he's the victim, but he persists in saying that Joe Biden is directing this prosecution for political purposes. It's very clear that what the Biden administration has done is to reinstate the separation between the Justice Department and the White House on prosecution of criminal cases, something that Donald Trump eroded with his very, you know, public suggestions that his attorney general should, for instance, dismiss charges or reduce sentences. That's not what's going on here. Trump, what he is in essence doing is talking about how he would run the Justice Department and not about how Joe Biden is.
The Justice Department, he used to call his Justice Department his Attorney General. Joyce, it is amazing to see you. Thank you, my friend. Thanks for everything you do for us.
Good to see you.
Joyce Vance is an MSNBC legal analyst. Coming up, control of the Senate this year may well come down to Ohio. We're going to get the latest on the Trump-backed nominee, Bernie Moreno, and what Ohio voters are thinking when we speak to the Ohio Democratic Congresswoman, Chantel Brown. She's standing by. That's next.
Biden, you voted for Brown.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Are you looking forward to the general election? Are you concerned that Ohio might lose its Senate seat?
I am. I think I am similar to a lot of people in that I'm not really looking forward to the next election. It's just a little uneasy.
About 2 hours ago, polls closed in Ohio where voters have decided which Republican candidate will square off against the Democratic incumbent Senator Sherrod Brown in November. While the three-term senator from Ohio remains popular, the race for his seat is shaping up to be one of the toughest Senate contests in the country. Senator Brown is one of just two Democrats running for re-election in states that Trump won in 2020, and their ability to hold on to their seats could determine whether Democrats hold on to their already thin Senate majority. In the Republican race to challenge Brown, NBC News has already projected a winner. Of the three Republicans who ran, NBC News can project that former car salesman Bernie Moreno wins Ohio's Republican primary for Senate. Moreno is the candidate who received Trump's endorsement. In fact, Moreno is the guy that Trump was campaigning for this weekend when he predicted a bloodbath if he loses in November. Moreno, a businessman who has never held a public office, has closely aligned himself with Trump on everything from immigration to a national ban on abortion. Joining me now is the Democratic Congresswoman Chantel Brown from the great state of Ohio. Congresswoman, good to see you. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Anything about tonight's results that surprise you?
Actually, no. What we know in Ohio is that the three Republican candidates were just fighting each other and not fighting for Ohioans, and that they were using their personal wealth, billionaire from outside the state's investment, to pour into their campaign to attempt to buy this Senate seat. And what we know in Ohio is that Senator Sherrod Brown has done the people's work, continuing to put people over politics, delivering real results and not rhetoric. So this is no surprise to us. And I expect that this will continue. They certainly left a lot of baggage for any of the candidates entering this race to carry in to compete with Senator Sherrod Brown. So this did not come as a surprise to me at all.
Give me a sense of why. Sherrod Brown is one of those guys who gets a lot of bipartisan support. He wins elections in places where the trend doesn't necessarily suggest that he might. Why is this as competitive as it is right now?
Well, Ohio is more rigged than it is red. Quite frankly, when you look back at what we saw from issue one, the November reproductive justice issue that was on the ballot to enshrine and protect women's right to make their own healthcare decisions, you could see overwhelmingly that we are a state that actually is more balanced than it is perceived. 51% of men in the state of Ohio were supportive of the reproductive justice issue. And when it comes to Senator Sherrod Brown, he knows how to deliver the message because he connects with people from all walks of life and on every level. He is a man that has supported veterans issues, leading the Veterans PACT Act initiative across the finish line on the Senate side, a strong advocate and supporter of labor rights. And so those are the things that makes him very much appealing to a broad constituency, that which is consistent in Ohio.
And help in that context that you just provided about Ohio and how it votes is important, because you talk about issue one, the reproductive rights referendum. 57% of Ohio voters in November voted to enshrine abortion rights in the state. But the support, the exit polls indicate that the Republican voters think the state's not conservative enough. All three of these Republican candidates support abortion bans. So tell me, how the math doesn't seem to be mathing on that.
Right. Well, I think Ohioans spoke loud and clear in August and November when they supported women's right to make their own healthcare decisions. And while the polls might say one thing, we know that polls don't vote. When it comes to elections, we have to look at the numbers, and we'll take a deep dive on the numbers of the outcome in this primary election to see where we can gain and garner support as it relates to expanding the coalition of supporters for Senator Sherrod Brown's base. But he's already had some magical math himself in being able to successfully win in Ohio. And I expect him to continue to be able to do that. So despite the polling, we are confident that with hard work, and clearly the Republicans see Senator Sherrod Brown as a real threat, but we are going to continue to fight and make sure that the voters are aware of how important it is to protect this slim Senate majority, as you led this segment with.
I would agree with you that polls are not the thing to go on, particularly on primary nights when they're exit polls. So you're dealing with a subset of a subset. But they are a little bit shocking, some of the responses. Amongst Republican voters, the exit polling indicates that 44% say immigration's the most important issue, economy's second, abortion's third. They asked a question about whether Biden legitimately won the election in 2020, and 63% of primary voters said he didn't. So I guess the reason I'm asking you this question is, when you are trying to win an election in Ohio in November, are you trying to deal with Republicans, or are you just trying to deal with getting Democrats out? Because these are very complicated conversations to have. If people in 2024 don't believe Joe Biden won the election, I don't know what the discussion looks like.
You're absolutely right. So what I would say to that is, we have to talk to everyone. We can't leave any of the voters on the table. We have to really be intentional about making sure that we deliver and talk to our base first and foremost. We cannot neglect them or take them for granted. As you've talked about, the issues on the mind of voters in the 11th congressional district specifically are the economy. They are concerned about issues around immigration as well as women's reproductive health. And so those are the things that we have to talk about. And those are winning issues for Democrats. When you think about the things that we were able to successfully deliver when Democrats had the majority, those are the things that we need to continue to build on. And the implementation of legislation such as the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really focusing on reducing prescription drug costs, making sure that we cap prices for seniors at $2,000 a year starting in 2025, capping the price of insulin at $35 a month right now. Those are real issues that are putting money back into people's wallets. And those are the things that Democrats did, no Republican support. When we talk about the abortion ban, all three candidates, Bernie Moreno included, support an abortion ban. So we have to get to the heart of the issues. Right now, I think it's important that people talk about the issues and not necessarily partisan politics. This is a time where we're going to really have to elevate the conversation beyond voting by party lines and really get more sophisticated as it relates to talking about things that are important to the voter. And what I know about Senator Sherrod Brown is he has the skills and the experience to be able to do that. And so do my colleagues, Congresswoman Beatty, Amelia Sykes, Marcy Kaptur, and Greg Landsman. We are going to be working collectively and collaboratively to deliver the vote in Ohio to ensure that the people of Ohio know who has been working for them and who continues to put people over politics.
Congresswoman, great to talk to you tonight. Thank you very much. Congresswoman Chantel Brown represents Ohio's 11th congressional district. Thanks for being with us. One last story coming up. What Senator Chuck Schumer's rebuke of Israel's handling of the war in Gaza could mean for the future of Israeli-American relations. That's coming right up. The southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, the city of Rafah, is now one of the most densely packed places on earth. It has more people per square mile than New York City. And for the nearly 1.5 million civilians who are currently trying to survive in Rafah, there is nowhere left to run. When the war started, Israel ordered the civilian population to evacuate the northern half of Gaza, saying the south would be safe. Then they attacked the south and told civilians to move farther and farther south until eventually they ended up packed into Rafah like sardines without adequate food, water, and housing. For all of those advances, Israel had U.S. support. Now, as the Israeli military prepares to move into Rafah, that does not appear to be the case. Today, the highest ranking Jewish person in American government, the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, today, Schumer told the New York Times that when writing his speech about the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last week, he contemplated going as far as calling for Netanyahu to step down altogether. For the past few decades, Schumer has been one of Israel and Netanyahu's staunchest allies. Schumer has defended Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He's called for Israel to strangle Gaza economically. He co-sponsored a bill that would have made it a federal crime to boycott the state of Israel. And when Netanyahu came to the United States in 2015 to deliver a speech criticizing Obama, a speech that dozens of Democrats, including then Vice President Joe Biden, refused to attend, Schumer showed up and applauded for Netanyahu. It cannot be overstated how big a deal it is for Chuck Schumer that Benjamin Netanyahu has now gone too far. Ultimately, last week, Schumer did not go as far as to call for Netanyahu to step down. Instead, Schumer called for Israel to hold new elections and explained why he thinks the Israeli people should vote Netanyahu out. Yesterday, President Biden called Prime Minister Netanyahu to warn him against invading Rafah. But today, Netanyahu announced that he plans to invade Rafah anyway. He doesn't think Biden or Schumer should be telling Israel what to do. For decades, the U.S. policy of unconditionally backing Israel has been pretty much set in stone. But if Netanyahu can lose Chuck Schumer, I don't know if that's the case anymore. And if Netanyahu really does decide to pull the trigger on a ground invasion that would undoubtedly kill countless defenseless civilians in Rafah, we might just be seeing the start of a new era of Israeli-American relations. That's our show for tonight.